Hey guys, welcome to What's the Pitch, where my co-host and I are going to be talking everything Dragon's Den and business pitches alike. My name's Pamela.
And I'm her co-host. Hi, I'm Maya.
Hey guys, welcome to What's the Pitch, and we are back for another episode. And we are going to be talking about a number of things. It's going to be a fairly packed podcast this week, I would say, Maya. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this was a really interesting, like, varied episode. I mean, we had another drinks brand, which is not unusual, but this was a plant milk-based cocktail, which I didn't know was a thing. We had a lingerie brand with a difference, and that was quite an emotional pitch. We had a black tea-based skincare range, and we had some people returning to the den for their second go, and they had a way to make glass sauce bottles work like squeezy ones.
It was a pretty packed episode, I would say. And yeah, you're right, really, really varied. Like, there was nothing, I mean, I guess, again, sustainability was probably at the heart of quite a lot of these things, that there was definitely a lot of thought going into that direction. But let's start with the plant-based vegan cocktail, which is also known as Panther Milk. This was by an entrepreneur called Paul Crawford, who used to be the owner of like a massive electronic club back in the day.
Sub Club, it's called. I looked it up.
Oh, did you? Okay.
And yeah, it's one of the like biggest clubs in Glasgow.
Oh, I see. Yeah, he was looking for £50,000 for 7.5% stake in his business. And the Panther Milk was based on a drink that he had tried in Spain, I think he said it was. Yeah, in Barcelona. So it was an interesting one. It was definitely not something I've heard of. To me, it looked like a milkshake, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, it's basically an alcoholic milkshake, right? Like, it's, yeah, he said he tried it in Spain. It's based on a drink they've been making there since the 1920s. And he brought it back to his club and it would sell out every week. It was really, really popular. But that was like, I think, based on like just normal milk. So dairy milk. And he wanted to kind of do something a bit different. And he decided to kind of reformulate it to use plant milks. And so now it's like 100% vegan, and he's trying to launch this new kind of drink that is also sustainable.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is Deborah asked what his demographic was, and he's looking at that kind of 18 to 25 demographic, which is the perfect demographic for both, I guess, clubs, because like now I'm into my 30s, I really just am not into that club scene anymore. So I think 18 to 25 is probably the perfect age. Also, you've got that demographic really pushing towards vegan. So I think he's got the right demographic there in terms of his target market. The cocktails themselves are 15%. Like, that's pretty strong, I would say.
Tuka was wincing, right?
So was Sarah. Tuka was kind of like, this is strong stuff. So yeah, I think he was talking about what he wanted to do with it, and in terms of a marketing strategy, because Stephen was asking, what's his marketing strategy? And I mean, he didn't really have one, did he? He was saying he did, but then he didn't really have one. It was like an experiential type.
His strategy was let people try it. So like, get it to people, let them try it. And like, that will be the thing that makes it makes it grow. But that's not really, a great strategy or a high growth strategy. Like, it's an okay strategy, but that's probably going to be quite slow growth. But yeah, he admitted he wanted Stephen's help. Like, before he came in the den, he said he was looking at Stephen and Deborah, because Stephen, for the fact that he's got this young target demographic, and Deborah, because he wants it to be a sustainable product and he wants his brand to have sustainability at its heart. So I think he kind of knew he needed a dragon to help with his marketing. He didn't have much of a strategy there.
Yeah, but unfortunately, Stephen wasn't quite interested. He was basically saying if he was to help, he'd probably need 90% of the business. And obviously that wasn't what was on offer. It was 7.5% that was on offer. So he wasn't interested. Stephen went out quite quickly. Tuca went out quite quickly as well. I think a lot of the Dragons kind of initially kind of thought just he's coming into the den a bit too early. And the reason for that was because, you know, obviously the numbers were being asked about. And so in 2020, he had made £31,000 in 6 months. And then I think he was forecasting £567,000 for the end of year one with a gross profit of £180,000, which would be amazing. But we're 6 months in, and rightly so, the Dragons challenged him. You know, you've only made £31,000 in the first 6 months. What makes you think you're going to hit over £500,000 in the next 6 months? And he did come back, I think, with the right answer, which was, you know, he's in talks with festivals and he's expecting each of the festivals to come in with like 150K. And he's like got two or three in the pipeline and he's secured two or three already. So yes, there's potential there. Like I could definitely see that happening. But then year two, he was expecting 1.89 million. And I feel like that's a massive joke. Like it's just way, like over three times what you're going to make in the first year. I'm just not sure where he got that number from.
Yeah, his numbers were crazy. I mean, even the festival thing is like, he thinks that he's got deals with like three festivals. He's got a couple he's talking to. He thinks that he's going to bring in all this money from festivals. This is kind of a crazy time to be planning your whole thing around festivals because we're still in the age of like festivals could get shut down if things, conditions change. So it seems like a risky strategy. And then even if that's your only strategy for growth, this whole jump to 1.89 million, I don't know where that's coming from. And that was the whole thing that prompted Stephen to be like, how are you going to get to 1.89 million? What is your marketing strategy? And he didn't really have one. And as you said, you know, Stephen went out because he didn't seem to have a strategy to actually back up the numbers. And Tuca thought it was too small, too early. What I thought was interesting, Sarah didn't actually like it. Like Sarah didn't think it tasted nice. So she was out
as
well.
She really didn't like it. Like she was, I think she was kind of roasting the product a little bit. She was just not happy with it.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to try it because I don't really drink milky cocktails. Like, you know, pina coladas the only are milky, quite creamy, yeah, I guess.
I was going to say, like, the only milky, creamy cocktail that I can think of is pina colada. But then I'm not the right person to discuss cocktails. You know me, I only really like mocktail. I'm not very good with cocktails. I don't actually know what's in them. But also, like, I don't know many cocktails that have milk in it. Like, I thought most cocktails were kind of like spirits and like fruit juices.
Yeah, most are. I mean, you have like White Russians, which is like cream and vodka, I think. And then you have liqueurs like Baileys, which are cream based. So I guess it's that kind of market. Yeah, which I mean, if it becomes as big as Bailey's, that's like that's a huge product. So you can see there is kind of potential there if it's a similar kind of product, which I don't know, without trying it, I wouldn't know. But it's an interesting one. But Deborah came in after like everyone had gone out and was thinking that there was potential here. We're asking how big is this market, but Deborah was talking about how there is a market for it and people who are vegan can't drink what's out there at the moment, and that she was talking to some drinks companies that were looking for this kind of thing, which was interesting.
And I think that kind of really aligned to kind of Paul's thinking. So I think he came in, you know, Peter and Tuca were talking about, you know, he's too small, it's a very early stage, it's highly competitive in this particular market. But I think because Deborah had these conversations with these other businesses and they were looking at this kind of thing, he actually came into the den at the right time for her. Like it's early enough for her to think, actually, yes, you know, she's done some market research. She's been speaking to drink brands and this is the route that they want to go down. So therefore, that's kind of helping her make her mind up about making an offer. And she did make an offer. She made an offer for all of the money, £50,000. But she wanted 30% of the business, so four times the amount that he was originally willing to offer.
The negotiation was like a classic haggle, right? Because she said 30, he was like, can we do 15? She was like, no. And he's like, can we do 20? And she's still like, no. But she did kind of meet him a little bit. She came down to 25.
I was surprised. I didn't think that she would come down. I thought she would probably stand her ground at 30. Yeah, no, he walked away with Deborah as the dragon, £50,000 and 25% of his business given to her.
And I think it'd be interesting. I mean, as I say, it's not a drink I've ever thought about having, but I'm definitely, after watching the episode, I definitely want to try it at least and see.
I feel like we've got a lot of market research to be doing after all of these pitches on this season, right? We said we'll try a lot of things. So if anybody's listening to this podcast and would like to sponsor us in any way and send us any free products, we will happily take that and give you a review on this podcast. Okay, moving on then to the next pitch. And this was an extremely emotional pitch. It was a luxury lingerie brand, which was run by two entrepreneurs called Caroline and Sarah. The business is called Love Rose Lingerie, and that was in memory of one of the co-founders' sisters who passed away from breast cancer. And they had spent 3 years doing product development of kind of really finding some sort of way to provide women who have had like breast surgery of some kind due to a medical condition to be able to feel sexy and feel like they can wear really nice lingerie, and really in that luxury lingerie space. So we're not talking like an everyday kind of bra underwear set here. We are talking kind of that really high-end luxury lingerie. So we're thinking like silk fabrics, really nice lace designs and everything, things that make a woman feel empowered. And they were basically saying that with women who have had, you know, reconstructive surgery of some kind, maybe because of breast cancer, there isn't really much on the market available to them. And if there is something on the market, it's usually quite plain, quite boring. And for them to feel good about themselves, it's really, really difficult. So they came into the den looking for £70,000 for 15% of their business. And it is really catered to help with breast cancer patients. So those that really want to feel really good about themselves afterwards. And every woman has the right to feel great about themselves, no matter what circumstances they're in. And I thought this was a really, really great product, and definitely along the right lines.
Yeah, I was really rooting for them because it was such a powerful pitch and like such an emotional story. And like what they're doing, I think, is amazing. And yeah, I really wanted them to be successful, but it was a tough sell, unfortunately.
It was a really, really tough sell.
Because the market they're kind of going for is like worth 7 million. And they're saying it's been catered for by like medical companies and like really boring companies, which you can see where they're going. But it's like, it's a niche already in terms of where it's a small market already. And they were at the high end, so you know, like £85 to £90, and a lot of that was, yes, it's luxury, but also because their manufacturing costs were just like really high. You know, they were getting it for £29, which Tuka was like, horrified by.
Yeah, it was really, really, really high, and I think part of that is because, you know, if you're not ordering many of the products, like much of the fabric or whatever it is that you're ordering, like there's no economies of scale, so they're having to pay a premium because the number of units that they're ordering, for example, is probably quite low. They are catering to an extremely small market here, and we're talking about like a subsection of a small market already, so it's not even that it's like a mass market. When you're catering to luxury, like you are catering to those that can afford this type of thing and that are willing to pay this kind of price point for their underwear. And it's really for those that have the disposable income to be able to do that. And we just have to remember, cancer doesn't choose its patients, right? It just happens. And you may be fortunate enough to, I guess, be able to buy this thing if you were in that unfortunate position. But many people probably wouldn't have the extra disposable income to be able to spend £85 to £90. And I think that that is quite tough, but they were good because they stuck to their guns, right? They could go down that kind of every day. And they talked about, you know, they were looking for some of the money to be used for kind of product development and maybe launching some extra products potentially. But the market that they started in was specific. And that specific market that they've asked for and that they've targeted for is going to be a very, very small subset. I think it's going to be quite hard to justify, you know, getting that extra investment. And I think it didn't help because, you know, sales to date, it was just too small for the Dragons to even consider. So their sales to date was around £7,500. So we're thinking like an extremely small business here. So unfortunately, they were unable to secure any investment from any of the Dragons.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a real shame because, as you said, they talked about going for a more basic product, but that didn't really impress the Dragons in the sense that once you get into that more basic, more affordable product, there's a lot more competition. So they kind of stood out at the luxury end. But, you know, it's already such a small market. If you're going to the, like, cheaper end of the market, the competition just makes it, like, not worth it at all because of how many people are already doing that. What was interesting was, like, Tuca and Steven's kind of little argument about it. You know, because Tuca was looking at for a way to increase the market size, and he was saying, you know, could they branch out into being like the specialty bra, specialty lingerie company? Could they branch into maternity? Could they branch into, like, yeah, any other aspect where it's just not a normal kind of bra? And they probably had the engineering to do that because they had some really good engineering in their product, but they unfortunately couldn't patent it because, yeah, it's just not something you can patent, because bras have been around for so long. Steven, like, so yeah, so there was that question of can they increase the market size. Steven didn't like that idea because he was saying, like, the current brand messaging is so strong, and it is so strong. He's right about that, but, and he was saying, like, you don't want to dilute that. You want to have that because it's so powerful online and push it. But then he also said it was too small to invest. So it was kind of conflicting from him because he was saying that they should keep focusing on what they're focusing on, but it's also too small to invest. So kind of had, like, mixed messages from him, I guess.
Yeah, it was a tough one, I think. I think personally, I just really, really wanted to root with them. Like, the other thing, though, was Sarah was talking about, you know, the price point was just too expensive, like £85 to £90. Like, she would only really spend £30 to £40, and she can afford to spend £85 to £90 on, you know, some underwear if she wanted to, right? But I was just thinking, I don't think that that's the right mentality behind it, because it really does depend. Like, if you walk into a shop like Victoria's Secret, some of the underwear there is priced extremely high, and I'm talking, like, you know, so just for the bra, you're looking at £70, £75. And then if you want to get, like, a matching set, then you're paying another extra £20 to £30 for the underwear. So you're looking at £100 there, which is probably around the same price point. It's a little bit cheaper, but not that much cheaper, right? So I kind of feel like that is a competitor. You're also then looking at the likes of, like, Agent Provocateur, you know, Rigby and Pella. Like, they are in that luxury space and they're doing pretty well. They cater to a specific audience. That audience has money, so that audience is willing to spend on items like these. If they go down the route of doing, like, an everyday type and something that is more catered to mass market, and I don't think it's even, like, mass market as such, because you can do, if you were to cater to the everyday, like, you can go to Primark and get a decent size, a decently priced underwear set nowadays. So it's probably more along that, if you're kind of in that mid range where it's like £30, £35, then you're kind of competing with the likes of, like, Marks and Spencer's, Bravissimo. But actually, even with Bravissimo, like, they because they cater to a specific audience as well, they're looking for kind of like the fuller bust woman. Again, it's a specific market. So I kind of feel like Sarah was a little bit wrong in the sense of saying their price point is wrong and they're not competing in the right market, because they're specifically wanting to cater to a specific market. And you can see, like, with all of these different brands that are out there, like, there is traction. And, you know, it's a huge, like, it is a huge, huge market, I would say. I think we have had the likes of some brands that have closed down in this area, like La Senza. La Senza was something that was quite big maybe about 10 years ago, but they had to close down because they went out of business. But generally, I think if you're pinpointing yourself specifically to a certain market, I think if you differentiate yourself and play yourself into a position where you're not in as saturated a market, so not the everyday, but in the luxury, I feel you've got a better chance.
Yeah, I don't think the luxury price point was that big a deal. I think, yeah, Sarah was kind of making out that it was. But yeah, I think the bigger issue is the fact that you're, as you said before, like, you're a subsection of the market rather than the whole market. So how big is that subsection? And so, yeah, I think it was, I wonder if it's going to be a big enough subsection. I hope it's a big enough subsection that even if they don't get investment, like, they can still make the business work, because I think it's a great business and a needed business. And so I hope they can make it work, even if it's just like not a business for a private equity investor, but a business that is like a lifestyle business for them, where they can kind of own that category. Because I think, you know, yeah, it would just be great to see them succeed, but unfortunately they didn't get an investment.
Absolutely agree with that. It is unfortunate. I kind of hope in some sense, like, even if they are a very, very small business, either, you know, they get consumed by a bigger brand maybe, and they work as like a subsidiary potentially. I don't know. I think that there is potential there. Moving on then to the next product, which is a vegan skincare brand that is made from Indian black Assam tea. This was quite interesting because I've never thought to use tea in my skincare brands. Although in saying that, like, the face cream that I'm using is tea. and I just didn't notice until I was like really looking at the products. I just couldn't remember that I was using a product that had like tea essence within it. So Zara Salim was an entrepreneur that was looking for £50,000 for 15% of her business, Delicious. And I thought it was delicious as in, like, you know, the food is delicious, but it was delicious as in like Delhi, as in the city in India, and then chess. So that was quite interesting. It was a good play on words, I thought.
I must admit, like, I didn't even realize it was like a pun, but yeah, that is a cool play on words. And yeah, this was like really interesting because it was all natural, vegan, cruelty free, and this thing like I didn't know about, which is Ayurvedic healing practice. So it's an Ayurvedic inspired skincare brand, and yeah, Ayurveda is one of the world's oldest healing systems. It comes from India and it's kind of passed down through the generations. So, you know, this entrepreneur, she learned it from her mother and her grandmother, and she developed a dry skin condition when she was pregnant with her second daughter, and she really, nothing was really working. She wanted something natural, so she decided to make her own skincare products. And it's interesting because I'd never heard of this, but then Stephen was like, Ayurveda's really big on Instagram at the moment, so I don't know if you've heard of it, but apparently like it's a big social media trend.
No, it hasn't come up on my social medias.
Yeah, I don't know, but apparently it's a big trend, which is good for her because it means she's kind of in the right place. She took a chance, launched this business when she was on maternity leave from being a primary school teacher, and got a kind of a good start. She got press, she got a deal with the Huck Group and supplied Glossy Box with 100,000 units of body scrub. And, you know, the product the product seemed to be really effective. Like when the dragons put it on their skin, they said it was really, really good. And, you know, she's basically doing body scrubs at the moment, three different body scrubs, and she's making them all herself at the moment. Like up until very recently, she reached a point where she'd outsourced it, but for a long time she was like making everything herself in like her kitchen, which is just crazy and very impressive. The one kind of issue was like the actual product design, the container design, because Peter, it was like a push, like you push it up and then it's like if you push it up too much, there's no way to get it kind of back in to the tube. And when they were trying, it was like going all over their hands. So I don't know, that maybe could have been a twist or something. Maybe she's needs to redesign that. So it's like you twist it up, you twist it down. I think the actual body scrub was really good. The packaging needed a little work.
Yeah, but I think because she did say she hand makes everything, but she's just started to outsource to a manufacturer. So maybe the packaging could change. I think if you hand make everything, there's only so much you can do if you don't have the right equipment or you're not great at like product engineering in terms of that, like you need somebody to help you. So maybe because she's outsourcing the manufacturing and stuff, like that can change. And she did say she was definitely open to having that change. I think the main thing that was interesting was her sales. So she started in 2018 and she made a decent amount of turnover, I would say 64,000. Year two, when it was starting to go into to pandemic, you would think that a brand like this would really take off. You know, a lot of people are at home. They've got time, I guess, to like look at skincare a lot. I for one, spent the first lockdown really, really focusing on my skincare because I was breaking out really, really badly. My skin was just not great. And I'd spent a small fortune on skincare products previously, but it just, like, I wasn't very consistent with it. And I always just thought, oh, I'm just so tired. Like, I just can't be bothered to focus on my skincare right now. I would buy all of these fancy products and spend the money on them, but then I wasn't using them in the right way to be able to reap the benefits that I needed to for my skin. So I spent a lot of, and I don't even know whether I was buying the right products. I was just kind of like going into shops and being like, oh, I need something for like dry skin, and not really looking at what the ingredients were. You know, I wasn't really focused on understanding what it was that was within the products that would help. Is there specific ingredients within here that's going to help with certain parts of the skin condition that, you know, the dry skin condition that I was having, or the patchy redness, or whatever it was. So I spent the first lockdown researching a lot. You know, I did a lot of research. I watched a lot of YouTube videos on skincare. I tried to think about the ingredients of what was being put into the products that I was using. And I really spent time focusing and harnessing in on what skincare products should I be using, what's right for my skin, what is working well for my skin, what's not working well for my skin. And unfortunately, I had to get rid of quite a few of my products because they didn't have the right ingredients for my skin. And actually, some of the ingredients were counteractive to what I actually needed. So I think it would have been the right time for a skincare product to really blow up. And probably because I was researching skincare products, I then had bombardment of Instagram ads and Facebook ads on just skincare. And a lot of it was like personalized skincare, for example, or new ideas, new ingredients that I hadn't heard of that I then went to research and figure out, is this going to work for me? But I spent a really, really long time because I had the time. I was constantly at home. And yeah, okay, I wasn't seeing anyone, so it didn't really matter. I guess some people might think it doesn't really matter whether or not I focus on my skin or not, but I just felt there was so much time for me to really focus on getting my skin in good condition that I was just like, now is the right time to be doing it. So I was concerned when she said that COVID started and her sales dropped significantly instead of increasing massively. I would have thought there would have been a massive growth potential there. So that was a bit concerning when she was talking about it, and it was concerning to the dragons as well, because that's what they were expecting.
Yeah, I mean the thing is that it was almost like she took her foot off the accelerator during COVID. I don't know if it was family things, she's got kids, so it was more like she didn't put the effort into the business during that COVID period, you know, the start of the pandemic, when, yeah, the business could have grown. It wasn't like a business where you had to go somewhere and actually like have a shop open. So, you know, she doesn't have a physical location. So she shouldn't really have been impacted by COVID that much. But I think she just kind of, yeah, didn't keep pushing the business during that period. And yeah, as you said, the sales dropped. It dropped to 25K. She's like making it up in year three because she'd done 45K in the first 5 months. She said she was on track for 150K with a gross of 100,000 and a net of 66,000. And she said she was kind of growing through social media. She'd grown a TikTok account to 40,000 followers, had some videos with millions of views, and sales had gone from about 2K a month up to 20K a month. So she was trying to say that there was that growth and that people were picking up on it on social media and like really getting excited about it. But there was two things. Yeah, the Dragons couldn't really get past the dip, that second year dip, because they were kind of worried that, like, you know, I think Steven said this, things go wrong in business. You have like these different kind of ups and downs. And it's like, they were kind of worried that, is this indicative of what will happen every time she comes up against an obstacle? Is this showing a lack of flexibility, a lack of adaptability, that she's not going to be able to pivot and change and, you know, deal with hard moments that come up? And they also didn't think, with all the press that she's got at the start with the social media and the millions of views on TikTok, that the sales, even though they were improving, were enough. They, with the numbers that she had in terms of attention and in terms of exposure, they thought she, her sales should have been a lot bigger. So yeah, they were worried that like the exposure she's getting isn't correlating to as many sales as you would expect. And as Deborah saying, that she doesn't think it stands out in quite a crowded market. And so that was kind of the worry that the Dragons had, is that she's getting this exposure. People are liking the videos, but they're not enough of them are buying the product.
I think part of that is also like the way in which she's distributing her product. So I don't use TikTok, but I would imagine that it's very similar to Instagram in the sense of, if you click on a TikTok video and it's like showing you a product, you could swipe up and do direct to consumer and just like, you know, pay for the product and get the product. Like, that's what I would expect. But she was saying that that
doesn't happen. I wonder, because like with that on Instagram, that's usually if you're doing paid marketing, right? So if she's had like organic videos go viral, it's usually, if it's working like Instagram, you're trying to get people back to your profile because you usually get like one link. Yeah, I don't use TikTok either, but I think, you know, I'm assuming you can at least have a link in your bio. So if it's on Instagram, you get a link in your bio and you try and get people to go back to your bio and like click on that link and buy your product. And so compared to platforms where you can just directly post links, it is a bit more work. So yeah, I don't know if to get that kind of feature on TikTok, you need to do paid advertising rather than, yeah, organic posts, because that's how it works on Instagram.
Oh, okay. Yeah, clearly I don't know enough about social media here. Well, so unfortunately, Zara didn't get any offers from any of the Dragons, but hopefully this will give her a little bit of exposure and maybe, you know, there'll be a little bit of a push in terms of her sales and she'll be able to grow the brand and expand the range as she wanted to. We then moved on to a little montage again. And the montage was basically of people coming to the den and launching new products and, yeah, just thinking about how scary it is to go into the den. I thought this was quite an interesting one because there were quite a lot of nervous people. And I think, you know, obviously right to be nervous. I think those that are more nervous are the ones that aren't as prepared. Those that are slightly less nervous are fully, fully prepared. But it was quite interesting because they had this montage because the next entrepreneurs had been into the den before.
Yeah, Peter Neef and Ian Wharton. And I remember this pitch, actually. They came in with the grill stream, which was like to stop when you're barbecuing, to stop the fat from whatever you're barbecuing from dripping into your grill. It like collected it. And it was interesting watching that old pitch back, because they kind of almost got an investment. And it was, you had Theo Pafitis, who was like saying, we can license this to people who make barbecues and make grills. And like, so what do we do next? You know, where do we go? And they kind of came back, the entrepreneurs came back and said, we're going to invent more products. And Theo was like, I'm out. You know, they snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. But in the end, they didn't need the dragons. The product did really well. And I think they sold it. And so they were really successful with their first product. So they decided to come back and give the dragons another chance to not miss out again on their next great invention. And what was interesting with how they kind of started the business was that they put videos online before they had a product. They launched with like a Twitter video of like it was kind of Kickstarter style. They kind of said, would you buy this product? And they put it on Twitter and they got 2 million views. And I think it was TikTok where they got like 48,000 views in 2 days. So that gave them the confidence to push ahead with this product. So they actually went ahead and got product validation before they started, which is an interesting strategy. And maybe like not enough businesses do that. But yeah, they felt like they have proven that people are interested in it. And their next great invention was when you've got your ketchup, your mustard, whatever, bottles, like brown sauce, all these kind of sauces. It's like squeezy bottles are single-use plastic, and they're trying to get people to go back to glass, basically, and get away from squeezy bottles. But squeezy bottles are more convenient. They just are easier to use. So they've come up with a product that you put on a glass bottle. Their product is plastic-free. It's 100% silicone, and it's like a little ball that you can squeeze, and it will pull the sauce out like a squeezy bottle. And, you know, it's the aim of, yeah, getting rid of that kind of single-use plastic, which it's debatable how environmentally friendly this actually is, right? Because you're going from single-use plastic to single-use glass. Now, glass is better in the sense that you can recycle it more times, but it's also, because it's not like you're not refilling the glass bottles.
Yeah, this is exactly what I was thinking about. The carbon footprint is
about the same, if not worse. Yeah. So, yeah.
I was thinking about that, right? Because yes, you can reuse glass, right? So finish using it once, wash it out, clean it, and then refill it. But what are you refilling it with? Am I buying another squeezy bottle, plastic bottle, to then empty it into a glass bottle to try and pretend that I'm going to be more environmentally friendly? Not the right thing.
No,
right?
It's not the right thing. And there's not many places where you can go and like take your ketchup bottle, your glass bottle, and like refill it with ketchup, right? There were some refillable stores popping up in London where, I don't know if they ever did ketchup, but you could do like washing detergent and, you know, cleaning products, and you could take back your bottle and just like refill it in the store and just pay for how much you refill it with. And they were doing okay. Apparently, like, a lot of them have struggled in the pandemic, so how well that sector's doing, I'm not sure. But with this, yeah, there's no real way to refill it. So their argument was like single-use glass was better than single-use plastic. It was more down the recyclability of it. So the fact that you can kind of recycle glass over and over and over again, and you can clean it more easily, because that's another thing, like plastic. If you don't clean the squeezy bottles like perfectly, they probably won't get recycled. Even if you put them in, they'll probably get rejected at the recycling plant. So glass does have some advantages, but the carbon footprint, it's a small change. It's not like the big change you need, which would be like, yeah, you have one glass bottle and you can take it somewhere and get your ketchup every time you need it or something. you know, or you could do like, yeah, put have it collected and refilled like milk bottles back in the day. They're kind of solving a problem, but not as well as it needs to be solved. Deborah was talking about how it could be more effective in the hospitality industry. And in the hospitality industry, you can actually like buy these things in bulk and then refill bottles. So yeah, this could be a really, really good way to move the hospitality industry to a more sustainable place. And that would be really good for the business, because then you would get these kind of bulk sales. You could sell to these massive companies that are buying lots of the product rather than trying to sell lots of individual ones.
So what was quite interesting, I think, was, yes, Deborah mentioned about the hospitality industry, and I think it was great. We moved on to Sarah and what Sarah thought, but Sarah was basically saying that the packaging wasn't great. Like, it came in a box, and the box doesn't really tell you what is inside the box and, you know, what it does or anything. So she thought this was perfect as a demonstrable product on like a TV shopping channel, right? You put it live on TV, you do a demo of it, and then you get like loads of people calling to say that they want to buy it. And obviously that is where Sarah's strength is. She has the connections to, you know, worldwide shopping channels. She would be able to do that. It would be able to be like mass growth, I think, if they were to demonstrate this and people were to buy it. So she talked about that. I think what the interesting thing was then after that was how Stephen came in with asking them a very direct question, and their answer just wasn't the best answer. They kind of shot themselves in the foot a little bit.
Oh yeah, which... they absolutely did. I mean, because the thing is, right, you had Sarah saying how good this would be on like TV shopping, and she's connected to TV shopping. And you had like Tuka asking them about the cost. So it's going to sell for £14.99 and again, it made for £3.60. And like Tuka thought they could get that cost down. They didn't know how much they could get it down if they ordered like more, but like Tuka can definitely help them get their costs down, right? So they had, when you're having those conversations, that means like, There's some interest there.
I think, okay, before we get on to exactly what happened, right? Let's just remind our listeners. These two are like veterans in the den. This is the second time that they're coming into the den, okay? So they should be a hell of a lot more well-prepared. And they should have, okay, yeah, Sarah wasn't in the den the first time round, right? When they did their original pitch. Neither was Stephen, I guess. I'm not sure whether Tuka was. Tuka might not be.
No, Tuka wasn't there.
But you're coming into Dragon's Den for the second time. You should understand what the experience is going to be. You should know what kind of prep work you need to have done. I mean, most of the entrepreneurs that come into the den for the first time know what each of the dragons do. They've done research on the dragons so that they've got an idea of as to, you know, who they want within the business, to like within their business, and who they would want to invest. Like, just even if you don't want that particular dragon, like if it's in the back of your mind that you've got certain dragons that you want and certain dragons that maybe don't align to what you're doing as much, or you know, you don't think you're going to work well with them, or whatever it is, do not shoot yourself in the foot by completely casting someone out.
No, like, play it cool, man. Play it cool.
Exactly.
At least until you have offers.
Like,
they took the bait so hard. Like, Stephen was like,
really bad.
What dragons do you want? It's like, don't answer that.
And he, like, all he, what he said, no, the way in which he framed the question, he was like, I'm going to ask you a question and I want a very direct answer. And he was like, which dragons have you come in here for today? And it's like, It was bait. Why did they take the bait? Any entrepreneur, I've never been on Dragon's Den, and I would have bloody well known not to say the names of the dragons that I would have wanted. I would have literally been like, I'm here to see what offers are on the table and who's interested in my product. I'll be happy to hear any offers and then I'll make a decision. You know, just why would you say, we've come here personally, I would like Peter and also you, Stephen. Like, why are you casting people out immediately after Sarah has told you this would be great on shopping, on TV shopping channels, and after Tuka said we could get that price down? Like, what in your right mind would make you cast them out? This could have been a five dragon investment.
They are still the same guys who came on the first time, because the first time they said dumb stuff when they were asked questions. So like, they're good inventors, and they just, but they, yeah, they haven't practiced or like thought through, like they, you would think they would kind of maybe like watch the old video and think, what did we do wrong? But no, they immediately, yeah, they immediately said what they were thinking in terms of who they came in for, and like ignored everything that had been said in the den before that, which is like, okay, you can come into the den and know who you want and know what the others can do. But when you have dragons in front of you, literally saying like, I can get you on TV shopping, this will do great on TV shopping, and they're connected to TV shopping and they can get you on TV shopping, it's like, why would you turn down that option? And it's like, have they not watched Dragon's Den at any point in between coming on it and now? Because every time you say like, I'm here for only these dragons, the others lose interest, because if you don't want to work with them, they don't want to work with you, right?
I mean, okay, so I'm in two minds about this thing. One, I think they were definitely in the wrong. The entrepreneurs, they were definitely in the wrong, right? Two, as a dragon, if I am fully invested, like, it's just taking that comment personally, right? That would make you not invest. Like, it's like a defense mechanism, right? You're kind of like, oh, I wasn't chosen, so therefore they don't value me enough, so therefore I'm not going to invest. But if it is a good investment to make, and I feel like I'm going to get a good return, I think even if they did say that originally, I would still probably want to invest. Like, if I genuinely think it's going to make me a good return. Because at the end of the day, the dragons are there to make money. So yeah. if you're going to get a good return, I'm kind of a bit like, yes, obviously it would be great. It will probably be like a passing comment in the future. Hopefully we'll be able to laugh and joke about it in the future. But I wouldn't, I think from that perspective, I wouldn't be like, I'm not going to invest because they didn't pick me. Like Tuka was talking about, you know, I'm never second choice. And Zara was like, you weren't even third, mate.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like, yeah, because they kind of point out that Deborah was their third choice. Yeah, I know, I totally agree. Like, this is the thing. What I was saying was like, if you've watched Dragon's Den, you know that that's what happens. If you kind of say that you don't want to work with a dragon, it turns them off, and like a lot of the time they're not interested. Is that the right thing? I don't know. I suppose when you've got so many people who want to work with you, you feel like you don't need to work with the ones who don't want to work with you. But you're right. If you can see real potential in the product and to make a good return, whether they kind of thought of you as their first choice shouldn't matter that much. It shouldn't, but it does.
An ego thing. It's a pride thing.
It's ego and it's pride. And you're coming to then and you're playing that game. And part of that game is not upsetting them. So, like, which these guys should know, because they were there. They've been in the den before. Like, that's the funny thing. Like, they should know that that was a possibility. If they committed to a couple of dragons early, that others would go out. So they should know. But I agree with you. Like, it shouldn't be as big a deal as they kind of, as Tuka was making it and Sara was making it. It shouldn't be that big a deal.
Yeah. So I guess what was interesting was that, you know, they talked about wanting Peter and wanting Stephen and potentially Deborah. Stephen was first to say, you know, he would want a partner because he doesn't have retail connections. And I think that was quite interesting because he talked about, you know, whether it be the dragon to his left or the dragon to his right. So we're talking about Peter and Deborah. And, you know, he was basically saying that he wouldn't go in alone. So Peter did think, could there be a three dragon scenario here? So between Stephen, Peter and Deborah.
Just before you go into that, because it was interesting because, like, you said they, like, potentially thought about Deborah. But they only really potentially thought about Deborah when Peter kind of offered or suggested the like three-way team up.
Because yeah,
they
this
weren't
is true.
Really talking about Deborah before. And then like Peter was kind of like, oh, this could be really good for three dragons. And that I think it was like Sara and Tuka were kind of like, oh, you know, now Deborah, your third choice, how do you feel about that? And to her credit, she was kind of like, she didn't really care. She was just thinking about the product and the investment and thinking, yeah, thinking about whether she would want to get involved and because of how sustainable it is. And that's when the stuff came up about glass versus plastic. But also, like, yeah, because she had identified how good it could be in hospitality and for sustainability in the hospitality industry, she was, yeah, she was open to the idea of doing like a three-way deal.
Yeah, I think it was quite interesting because this was when Stephen, Peter and Deborah were kind of having like a dragon confer, not at the back of the wall, but, you know, behind Stephen's notebook, you know, trying to discuss what they wanted.
Yeah, there. It reminded me of like tennis when they play doubles and they kind of hide what they're saying behind like their hands and stuff. It was like, it was, yeah, they were having like a little secret dragon negotiation to try and work out what percentage they would do for the 75k.
And yeah, they went in for a third of the business, which was acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, the entrepreneurs tried to counter at 30. They tried to get like a little bit, but the dragons were like, no. They were like, no, we're going to have, we want not. A third. You know, we want a third. You guys are going to have like a third each. We'll have a third. That's fair. And yeah, the entrepreneurs are like, we're not going to throw away a deal a second time in the den. So they accepted it. And yeah, second time lucky for these guys.
I think they were really lucky. I genuinely think they were really lucky. They could have 100% done like history repeating themselves and shot themselves in the foot completely to no investment. Yeah,
but then the last time, you know, after the then it made money. So they know how to make money. They just don't really know how to pitch. Dragons even a second time around.
Yeah, exactly. Well, guys, thanks for listening. That's all we've got time for on this episode of What's the Pitch? And we'll be back with you next week. If you enjoy listening to us, please do follow us on whatever platform you're streaming us on, and we'll speak to you again soon.